Welcome back to the Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. I am your host, Nick Agar-Johnson. It has been a long summer slash beginning of fall, but college basketball is almost back. NBA basketball is back. WNBA wrapped up with a, let's say, questionable game five. But, you know, as a New Yorker, I have to root for the Liberty. So I'll say exciting game five. And I'm here to kick this No Ceiling season off with Maxwell Baumbach. Maxwell, how are you doing this fine evening?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on. Usually when we talk, it's because I made you edit a 90,000-word column about guys who will go on to play in summer league someday. So I appreciate you taking the time to have me on Deep Dives here.
Well, spoiler alert, we will talk about some summer league play later on in
yeah,
the podcast.
Yeah, yeah,
I know you will. I know you thought you were clear of summer league, given that it was, mm-hmm. you know, 4 months ago and the NBA started. But no, there's still summer league talk to be had.
Mm-hmm.
Draft sickos never quit. So let's start off. So today we're going to be talking about your article that went up on Monday afternoon about five players facing a make or break season. And we're going to go through all five in detail, but we're going to start at the top with one of the prospects who I think has one of the most interesting seasons ahead for them.
Sure.
And that's someone who's been on draft radars for a long time. So we'll sort of break down the Nolan Hickman specifics in a moment. But before we get into that, I'm curious, what led you to write this particular article at this point in time, right before the college season begins?
Yeah, it's something I've been thinking about a lot. And it's something that after we did sort of our initial behind the scenes boards to help with the deciding who was going to be in the draft guide, like I kind of caught myself wondering, like, am I sagging too much on guys who've been on the cusp for a long time? Because it feels like every year, like those guys are kind of on the cusp for a reason. And then they're the ones that end up doing something. So like in the article I mentioned, like Terrence Shannon, like Ochai Agbaji, Marcus Sasser, like these were guys that were on the radar year after year. And by the time they got to their senior year, I was like, oh, is this guy ever going to do anything? And like, I'd rank him like 95th on my preseason board. And then they'd have a great year. And it's like, oh yeah, they were on the cusp because like they have these tools, they have these skills. Like there's a reason that they were always kind of in the mix. And them, you know, maybe taking a little while longer to put it all together or break out isn't necessarily their fault or something that should be held against them. I think even had Kevin McCullough not got injured last year, I think he would have been another one of those guys for like early in the year prior to the last injury. He was like in the teens and 20s on a lot of boards. So and I still kept him there because I love Kevin McCullough. But yeah, I think for a lot of the guys that are upperclassmen, they sort of lose that shiny new toy feel and excitement. And we get excited and we rank all these freshmen really high and all these guys that, you know, personally guys that I think, oh, this guy might break out, I put him higher. And it's like, maybe you should just like take the guy that's been on the cusp for a while, because they break out too quite often.
Well, it's funny because the first player we're going to talk about is someone who not only has played along quite a few current NBA talents, but also, I always pair him in my mind with someone who had that season last year in Hunter Salas. So we're talking here about Nolan Hickman. And, you know, for Hickman, for me, I always sort of associated him and Salas together as, okay, top recruits, right? Hunter Salas was 15th in the 2021 class. Nolan Hickman was 26th in that class. Mm-hmm. And with both of those guys, you know, part of this is because I was too low on Andrew Nembhard. And that's a mistake that I've tried to learn from. Part of it also is that I have been and continue to be very high on Julian Strother.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what happens when you have those guys in the mix, plus, you know, destroyer of worlds, Chet Holmgren, and, you know, the guy the offense ran through who we haven't mentioned yet in Drew Timmy, right? It's very easy for those kind of guys to get lost in the shuffle, especially since both of them in year one, anyway, were playing behind Rasir Bolton too.
Yeah.
Right. So it's two guys who are incredibly highly recruited, playing for, you know, a team that ended up first in the AP poll at the end of the year, right? Just absolutely stacked Gonzaga team. And you only get to see so much of what those guys could do. And so, you know, if you go back to the high school rankings, it's like, okay, well, you know, these are both guys who should have a breakout chance somewhere, right? And it, you know, comes into play very differently for both of them. Salas had to transfer, you know, had to have his big year at Wake Forest before he started shooting up boards last year. And certainly is someone I have in my first round at this point in this season. But now we'll get to see if Hickman has that chance with, you know, some of the ridiculous logjam ahead of him starting to clear up.
Yeah, yeah, I'm excited for him. And I know, like, I believe Ryan Nemhard's still there. It's like there is still another kind of guard in the mix. So I don't know how much a true point guard responsibility, like, he's even still going to get.
Sure.
But, like, now that I've been kind of in the weeds doing this for a few years, it's been interesting because, like, Hickman was a guy that 3 years ago would, like, still pop up on mocks occasionally, like, during his freshman season. Like, people would be like, I kind of like him in the second round or whatever. Like, and now everyone kind of goes back to school. Like, expectations have shifted. The whip has been cracked very hard against small guards. So, like, that hasn't helped. But, like, he's always, like, I don't know that people that are newer to, like, the draft community realize, like, how hyped he was at different points. And then going into that sophomore year, it was like, well, he's going to have a breakout year. And then, like, they brought in Malachi Smith, Ryan Nemhard's there. Like, it just didn't happen. It didn't materialize. But then, like, I don't know, like, some of the times I'd watch Gonzaga this year, I'd be like, oh, this guy's, like, starting to figure some stuff out, especially with regard to his pull-up scoring. He's always been, like, a really low mistake playmaker, which I appreciate to a degree. And I'm just kind of like, man, is this guy, like, somebody that does it this year? Like, is he finally going to just show out and really get more usage and get to do more with the ball and really show why he's kind of been in that mix for so long?
Yeah, I think in a weird way, there's also a comparison to make with Caleb Foster in that it's the same sort of situation with, you know, okay, you're brought in as part of an incredibly talented freshman class to a ridiculously loaded roster. And, you know, with Duke last year, Jared McCain broke out, but he broke out eventually, right? It was like, take until the second half of the year, really. And, you know, if Hickman gets the kind of run that he could, you know, especially given how much he played, how much of a focal point he was for Gonzaga last year, right? And yeah, you know, the Ryan Nemhard thing does complicate the calculation a little bit, but I'm curious sort of with Hickman, because he's someone who, as you mentioned in the piece, is an incredible shooter.
Yeah.
You know, how much of the dynamic there is that he needs to figure out more on-ball stuff just because he's not big enough to play off guard? Or do you think there's sort of, you know, there's a world that CJ McCollum's of the world succeed in, right? You know, there's a world in which Norman Powell's of the world succeed, right? You know, slightly undersized combo-ish guards, if they're good enough at the combo part, there is a role for them, right? It's more sort of the, I would argue it's more sort of the pure 6 foot point guards that are getting squeezed more than of 6 foot three combo guard types.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. I think 6'3", like, some guys still kind of get lumped into it. I think with Hickman, he can almost play a little bit smaller than he is. Like, something I mentioned in the article is, like, he doesn't really rebound at all.
Yeah.
And, like, he's got to defend better is the other thing with him. Like, if you go back and watch the game against Purdue, I wouldn't really say it was targeting him because it wasn't in the traditional sense, but a lot of their plays just involved a lot of off-ball movement with their guards, and he was a step behind the play way too often. Like, if you go back and watch that game, it's rough for him defensively. And I think if you're going to be kind of that combo off-ball guard, which a lot of guys are going to have to be, like, I think if you're going to be a backup point guard in the modern NBA, like, you do have to be able to play without the ball. And I actually like that about Hickman, is that he can just, like, absolutely stroke it off the catch. Like, really good off movement, like, has some real range on his shot, and then has that pull-up game that he can run pick and roll and just hit the roll man to do the simple stuff. Like, really good at spot ups, really good at pick and roll. But I really just need to see more from him defensively for him to kind of be somebody who squeezes into that role. Like, I feel like a lot of those like Marcus Smart style guards, where it's like Marcus Smart was technically the point guard in Boston for a long time, but, like, didn't really run the offense through him, but it was this massive defensive impact that allowed him to, you know, be on the court so often. Like, with Hickman, the defensive impact is quite negative. So, like, he's really got to turn that around and find other ways to affect the game.
I'm fascinated that Marcus Smart is so often the comp for these sorts of things. And it makes me think as well about Jalen Suggs, who was someone I was very high on in his draft class, where they come into the league and the idea is, you know, with Smart much more than Suggs. Smart was a much better passer at OK State than Suggs was at Gonzaga. But, you know, the concept being, OK, they come into the league, they're these great athletes who can, you know, make plays with the ball in their hands and who you buy into the defense being, you know, some kind of level. And for both Smart and Suggs, it's turned out, okay, maybe the on-ball equity wasn't quite what people thought it was, but they make up for it with the defense.
Yeah.
With Hickman, it's not only that the defense isn't there, it's that I think if, you know, to compare him to a Marcus Smart, Jalen Suggs archetype, there also has to be a lot of on-ball juice, right? Both of those guys,
Smart
more than Suggs, but both of those guys had at least the potential of, you know, serious on-ball juice coming into the NBA. And then, you know, turns out they're best served mostly being off-ball defensive guys. And certainly Suggs and Smart both have carved out careers for themselves as all-defense type guards. But given that Hickman isn't the all-defense type guard, right, he needs to do both of those things. He needs to be a, you know, high-level playmaker and a good defender. And the playmaking is, you know, easier to see being a real thing translation-wise, but he needs both, I think.
Yeah, and like the other thing I keep kind of coming back to with him is like where I get scared is because I worry about like the defense and lack of rebounding. Like if he's going to be more of the off-ball shooter type who's not like super defensively tilted, then like, I don't know, like it just feels to me like physically there's like a world between like him and Peyton Pritchard. Even if he's taller than Peyton Pritchard, like Pritchard was like quicker, stronger, more explosive. Like he's kind of lacking some of that stuff. So it's like, well, then do you have to be like a Devontae Graham or like Bryn Forbes level shooter where it's like, it's just knocked down every single time. And then we can still kind of get away with the defensive and the stuff and the rebounding stuff being kind of what it is. Like I'm scared for Nolan Hickman in that standpoint, if like the offensive role doesn't like really come along.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around, waiting for the track to dry, is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
So let's move on to the next player. And this is particularly entertaining for me because before Stephen Gillespie joined the No Ceilings crew, he had a podcast called Draft Capital. And I was one of the, I think I was the second guest on that show. And one of the players we talked about, this was, God, it's got to be like almost 3 years ago at this point. And one of the players we talked about was Matthew Morrell.
There we go.
So we're bringing it back in style.
Yeah, he's one of those guys who, again, has like been on the radar forever. I think he was at like either Elite Camp or the Combine like 2 years ago. And then again this year, like just sort of always been in the mix. It's this sort of athletic combo, like switchblade guard kind of guy where he's going to give you some real defensive juice. He can play make a little bit. He can get his own shot. And then this past year under Chris Beard, like made a really big leap defensively, like posted 2.8 steal percentage, which is fantastic. 0.8 block percentage. Like his measurements are kind of weird. Like he measured, I think, under 6'3 at the combine, but then he had like a over 6'8 wingspan. So you can still kind of play him as like that off ball guard. Like he kind of can play the two because of that. But defensively, like I love what he can do, like can really move his feet. The ground coverage is stellar. Like there's a clip that I posted in the article where like he walled off a drive. He did a quick dig into the post. Post player senses it, kicks it back out to the perimeter. Morrell recovers over to his man, closes out and like flies off the floor and blocks the shot at the end of the shot clock. And it's like, I love that. I love everything about that play. I love that you can stay in front of your man. You can try to make a play into the post, make a big guy panic, make up that ground, block a shot. Like I really like what he's bringing defensively, even if he is a hair undersized. I think the questions are just going to be kind of offensive consistency. Like his true shooting percentage is a roller coaster over the years. He's always shot threes. Like his career per 100 numbers, he takes 10.5 threes per 100 possessions, which is great. Like you want a wing who's willing to shoot like that, but the percentage is 35.5 and it's been down then up, down then up. So it's like, all right, well, we need to like know that that's real if we're talking about him getting into the top 60 conversation. And then I have some frustrations with a shot diet as well, which we can get to in a little bit. But where are you kind of at with Morrell before we get into the tweaking?
Yeah, I'm the highest on him out of the five players that you cover in this piece. And I think the main reason for that is exactly what we just brought up with Hickman. I'm much less concerned about with Morrell. Like he doesn't need the ball in his hands as much. You know, the shooting inconsistency is a problem, but there's a gigantic gulf between shooting inconsistency and can't shoot. Yes. And, you know, every once in a while, you get the once in a blue moon, Kawhi Leonard, Ryan Dunn immediately learns how to shoot upon reaching the NBA, right? But that doesn't happen very often. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of ramp up to get to the point where someone you know, has a viable shot with Morel. There's the added problem that, you know, my sort of free throw truther thing, I've beaten into the ground, and I will continue to beat into the ground because I continue to believe in it, right? But with Morel, you know, he's at 76% for his college career, but he was at 84% 22-23 and 74% last season. So as his three-point percentage flipped from 30% to just under 40%, his free throw percentage went from 84 to 74. And the reason that I, you know, refer to myself and think of myself in that sort of quote-unquote free throw truther way is oftentimes the combination of sample size and variance with free throws is a better indicator of how someone will shoot at the NBA level as opposed to how they shot at the college level. You know, I've called this the Derek Williams principle before, right? Of like, if you get really lucky for like 2 months on three-point shots and people think, oh, wow, this guy's a, you know, 52% or whatever Derek Williams shot that 1 year at Arizona, you know, he's that level of shooter. Doesn't quite work like that, but you see a lot less variance usually. And I'm emphasizing usually here. You see a lot less variance usually with the free throws. And the fact that Morel's got the kind of variance he does on the free throws as well, you know, that sort of leads me to believe, okay, maybe this guy's just a streaky shooter. And that happens, right? You know, some guys are just streaky and they're streaky their entire careers. And that's just sort of how it is. But, you know, with Morel, there are so many other tools, and he's someone who I think the kind of player he is will need the ball in his hands less than Hickman. And therefore the fact that, you know, he's not a elite playmaker, the fact that he's a good playmaker, as you mentioned in the piece, but, you know, not elite, I think that's less of a problem for him than it is for Hickman. And the wingspan comes into account here too, right? Like, you know, the fact that he's got the length that he does makes me more willing to buy into the notion of, okay, maybe he can switch one through three. Whereas with Hickman, it's like, you're lucky if he can switch at all, right? You need a smallish two guard for him to be able to switch, period. So, you know, all of that sort of put together in one package, the shooting inconsistency, yeah, it's a problem, but I'm not sure it's a solvable problem. Again, some guys are just streaky, and there's reason for me to believe certainly that he's one of those guys that's just streaky, but everything else with the package makes me very willing to buy in. And certainly he's someone who, if not in my top 60, will be right around the border of it most of the year, unless he blows up. And then we have to talk about him as a lot more than a top 60 guy, which I'd love to see.
I would too. Your point on the free throw thing is so interesting. I have like these spreadsheets that I keep of guys who've like stuck in the league, and like you go to like his career free throw percentage and under, and it's a ton of guys who are like up and down from three. Like it's RJ Barrett, it's Lou Dort, it's Christian Brown, it's Josh Hart, like Dylan Brooks, like guys that, yeah, like they just have years where they don't make threes and they have years when they do. Like that's what he is. But again, like with a lot of those guys, like they're guys who are athletic, they provide defensive value, they can pass the ball a little bit. Like all of them have some of the same things that Morel has. And that's, I think, what makes him interesting. I think the biggest like easy fix in his game is the shot diet. Like he takes a lot of mid-range pull-ups that he really doesn't need to take. Like there were so many times I watched the film where he would draw a hard closeout, pump fake at the guy off his feet, and then he still pulls from like 17 instead of like, dude, you can like jump out of the gym, like just go to the basket and like put somebody on a poster. Like I think he took like 11% of his half court shots at the rim. Like it was a really low number. And it's simply a fun, and like spacing, like sometimes that plays a role. Like Cade Cunningham like barely got to the rim in college, but like it's still a problem in the NBA. Like some guys just are comfortable resorting to that pull up, and like that is something with Morel's game that if he wants to get that NBA role, like coaches are not going to like that habit. They're going to want to see him just attack the rack.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where, you know, you mentioned Cade Cunningham. I think there's an element to which, look, if you're the lead guy for your team's offense in college, but you are decidedly not going to be that kind of player in the NBA, you know, there's a difficult sort of calculus for me anyway of, okay, how much of his bad shot diet is just he falls in love with the shot a little bit too much? And how much of it is just he knows that either he's going to get a shot clock grenade with 2 seconds left, or he's going to pull up for the mid-ranger with 18 left, right? It's like, if he's more comfortable with that shot, you know, I can understand the logic of like, we're not getting a good look on this possession. I can, you know, get to 18 feet and pull up. Yeah, there's time left on the shot clock, but if I pass it around, the ball's just going to stall and it's going to end up in my hands anyway, right? It's like, you know, that's something that certainly I felt was the case with Keontae George back when he was at Baylor. You know, how much of this bad shot selection is you genuinely love your shot too much, and how much of it is the ball is going to end up in my hands anyway, and I'm more comfortable with this look than reversing it back out and crossing my fingers that one of my teammates creates a, you know, disadvantage for the defense that we can exploit, right? It's like, if you get to 11 seconds left, then there's nothing doing. Maybe it's not as bad of an idea to take that shot as opposed to in an NBA context where it's like, if you take too many of those shots, you know, maybe you get pulled. And certainly, you know, unless he ends up working his way into the lottery, and even if he does end up working his way into the lottery, which, you know, again, I'm saying the sort of absolute ceiling. Even if he does reach that sort of absolute ceiling, do we really think that NBA teams are going to say, all right, Matthew Morrell, go to work on, you know, I don't know, Jaden McDaniels and get this 19 footer for us, right? Yeah. It's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so if he can cut those shots out of his diet because they're just, I need to take those for Ole Miss, sure. If that's more of a longer term problem, then I get more concerned. But as someone who tends to get more turned off by bad shot diet prospects than I should, I'm more willing to give players like Morrell the benefit of the doubt than if, you know, I don't know, if he were playing alongside Cade and was still doing that, right?
Yeah. I see what you're saying. I think that's spot on. Because, yeah, I'm trying to think of examples of, like, guys who did that and, like, didn't stick because of it. But,
I mean,
they're not memorable because they don't stick. But, yeah, like, that's the thing is it would be different. I wonder if, like, Cam Reddish would be, like, he's obviously still around. But, like, that's another guy who just, like, didn't get to the rim a whole lot in college and, like, likes to kind of mess around in the mid-range a little too much. Like, that's... And that's been a struggle for him in the NBA. It's like, I don't know how content he's been to just like stand in the corner and launch open threes or like attack the rim hard. Like he kind of likes to play that way.
I mean, I think part of the difference there is Cam Reddish can get away with it for him because he's much bigger. And therefore
100%,
has a lot more defensive equity. Like Morrell has to be a well above average defender to stick.
Yes.
And also be good offensively, right? Cam has, and I presume will continue at least for a little while, to stick around essentially mostly to play defense, and coaches just sort of live with some of the questionable offensive choices. But, you know, sometimes that player's Cam Reddish and they stick around, and other times it's Kevin Knox, right?
Yeah. Great example. Exactly.
So let's move on to the next player on the list, Matthew Cleveland. And you know, he's someone who it's a different sort of calculus than it is for either of the two questionably sized combo guards, right? With Cleveland, you know, he's legit wing size and
he's
legit a, you know, shoot first shooter, right? He's someone who you're putting him out there to space the floor. And, you know, as you mentioned in the piece, I think, you know, this is more and more relevant as we see the NBA sort of move away from pure shooting guys that even at that size, you do need to play some level of defense to be able to stick. And the example that I always go to here is just because it sticks in my mind is Troy Daniels. Man, could he shoot the cover off the ball. And he was 6'6", too, right? He wasn't, you know, some tiny, you know, 6'1 guard getting exploited for his size, right? But he just could not play good enough defense to stick. And he couldn't do anything when, you know, there was a hard closeout.
Yeah.
You know, with Cleveland, that's certainly a difference in that he's much more comfortable attacking those closeouts. But, you know, every time I see someone who is in that sort of wing size area and is billed as a pure shooter, I'm starting to wonder more and more about how long those guys can last if that's all they do. And, you know, again, with Cleveland, you know, there's more to the offensive package than only shooting, but the defense needs to reach some level higher than the current level for him to stick around. You know, three is one thing. 3 and D is a lot more likely of an archetype to have a longer term NBA role.
Yeah. And like, he's still like low volume from 3-2 is the thing where it's like, Cleveland is like such a tease. Like, I feel like every year I'm like, this is going to be the year. And then I'm just like annoyed with him by the midway point of the season. Like, he's one of those guys where he's so frustrating because, like you mentioned, he's NBA size. He's 6'7", he's 210, he's big, he's long. And then like everything just feels like it's a little bit worse than it should be. Like he hit 37.2% of his threes. And he took 5 per 100 possessions, which is like low, but it's not like obscenely low for a forward prospect, but it is on the lower side. And like, because the roles he's had, like you mentioned, like the pure spot up stuff, like, is like not a problem with him. He can put it on the floor. He can like see a little bit. He can hit mid-range shots. He can finish. Like, there's a lot of stuff he can do. other than shoot offensively, which is good. And then like the defense just always feels like it's not quite where it should be. Like he can stick with guys. He gets up really well out of his slide, which is something I always like. You know, good ground coverage. And then, yeah, like I don't know. At the same time, like one thing I mentioned in the article is he took more pull-up twos than rim attempts,
which is insane.
And like this is what we're talking about too. Like this is another example of like a guy who was genuinely in a role where like it would be easier to not take those shots. Like you had Luka Popler, you had Nigel Pack, you had Bensley Joseph, you had Norchad Omir. Like there were other guys that did stuff on this team that you did not need to take those shots. And now Miami was kind of a mess last year, so maybe this year things will be a little bit different. Guys will be more accepting of roles and it'll be a little bit cleaner of a fit. But like he just loves taking bad pull-up twos. And then defensively, like he's way too content to let his man get by him. And like I think that's one thing when you are Jalen Tyson or Dalton Knecht or these guys that had these massive offensive roles for their team, but like Cleveland didn't. So it's like why are you doing this, man? Like what's going on here? So with Matthew Cleveland, like I just want to see a commitment to doing things a little bit better. I just want to see a commitment to like taking more threes off the catch, getting all the way to the basket, not taking the mid-range shots, defending a little bit better. And this sounds like I'm killing him. Like it sounds like I'm raking him over the coals, but like he just needs to get a little bit better at all of this stuff. And then like he's there. Like that's what's the crazy part is like he's really skilled for a guy who's 6'7". And there's no reason he shouldn't be a good defender. And then if he just like hits threes, like we're in business. Like that's, he's there. So that's why I kind of get frustrated with Cleveland is because like I see so much in him and it just hasn't quite clicked the last 2 years the way I've wanted it to.
I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head with one of the first things you said about him is he's a tease. He's so close to reaching the level where, you know, everything will just click. And, you know, yeah. You mentioned Ochai Agbaji earlier, right? Like I'd had a first round grade on him since his first season. But it was like just a little bit more, just a little bit more, just a little bit more. And then finally, you know, the 1 year comes along where he does figure all of that out. And, you know, all of a sudden he is shooting at a high level and he's also having offense run through him. And that's the sort of last thing I want to touch on with Cleveland before we move on to the next player on the list is that shot diet is one thing when it's occurring in Morrell's context. It's another thing when it's occurring in Cleveland's context, both in terms of the shots that he's taking, but also in terms of, you know, if he just passes out of a few of those looks.
Yeah.
Like that's really all it takes, right? Is, you know, his assist rate for how often he had the ball in his hands was pretty slim for a prospect of his size.
9.4.
And if he just kicks out of a few more of those terrible mid-range looks, right, that alone might do wonders for everything, right? You know, teams are a little less willing to just sort of let him drive and we don't need to care about cutting off passing avenues because he's not going to pass, right? Like, just the kind of defensive attention that he's getting, if he's just that little bit more willing to be a playmaker, then, you know, that solves a lot of this too. Really, a lot of it is, as you mentioned, tiny improvements in a whole bunch of different areas, but also if he takes a significant enough step forward in a couple of key areas, like a little bit better of a playmaker, a little bit better of a shooter. That's really,
like, I can live with it. Hope the defense figures itself out later. Like I can bite if it's just like one or two of those things.
Baseball fans, think you know who's hitting a homer today? Well, FanDuel is giving you a free chance to call your shot with daily dingers. Joining the action is easy. Just make your free pick on who's hitting a home run in their game, and if you're right, you'll get a profit boost to use on your next bet for a chance at extra winnings. You've got nothing to lose and a lot to gain. And don't forget, you can make a free pick every day during the MLB season. It's just another reason why FanDuel is the home for home runs. So, are you ready to play your game today? Join all the action at FanDuel.com/podcast. That's FanDuel.com/podcast to play daily dingers and make your free pick on who's hitting a homer. Play ball and swing for the fences on FanDuel, an official partner of the MLB.
Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. A bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
So let's now move on to someone who was a social media darling a couple of years ago and is in a bit more traditional, let's say, of a basketball context now. Mm-hmm. And that's Grant Nelson, who after 3 years destroying the Summit League for North Dakota State, transferred to Alabama last year. And I think I would say the best way for me to put it is solid, but not spectacular. Like, yes, he wasn't destroying the world like he was in the Summit Conference, but he clearly was good enough to be an SEC starter. And then the 100%. Question, is just, you know, okay, where do we go from here? Because like the social media darling thing was just because he's a ridiculous athlete, right? Mm-hmm. But that's not enough, or Seventh Woods would be in the NBA right now.
Yeah. And it's a combination of like the athlete stuff, I think, mixed with the size, where it's in like the idea that he could shoot because he has a pretty shot, but the shot has like never actually gone in is the problem. Like he's a career sub 30% 3-point shooter, which like, granted, bigger guys don't shoot as well pre-college, and like the free throw numbers are pretty good, but like I'm just not convinced that's him. And he is like a really good slasher is the thing. Like when he like cuts to the basket and is like rolling and Mark Sears just hits him at the right time, like that looks great. Like I wrote in a quick hit during the season at one point, like, man, I wish Grant Nelson just like went to the basket more. Like I know that the idea of him is like unicorn 3-point shooter athlete, but it's like, I kind of just like the athlete stuff. I don't need you to take that many threes if you're not going to hit them.
Like, it's rare that you shoot 60% on twos in the Summit League, go to the SEC, and then boost that percentage.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and he made 61.9% of them on twos that came in like a spot up setting, which like generally, like using like the synergy qualifier for that, that's generally like you got chased off the 3-point line and you had to do something. Like, he can attack a closeout. Like, he can do that. He can roll to the rim. He can catch lobs. Like, that stuff is there. And then like the defense is really weird. Like, he also posted a better block rate at Alabama than he did at North Dakota State. And like, I would say the biggest reason for me being kind of a Grant Nelson agnostic the last 2 years was just this idea of like, I don't really know if the shot's real. And if it's not, then like, I can get a big guy who's going to finish, but can also play defense instead. And Grant Nelson's always been sort of a tweener defensively. Like, he can slide his feet pretty well, but he's not great at it. And then like, he's not a very good like pick and roll defender. He's really jumpy in ball screen coverages. Like, he's just kind of all over the place. But his block percentage went up throughout the year, and I think he did start to like figure things out, and he plays really hard. Like, he's always trying, which I will take. Like, I will take the guy who is hustling, especially with those athletic tools, that makes a mistake here or there over like, I don't know that this guy cares about being a good pick and roll defender.
Sure.
Like, I very much get the sense that Grant Nelson wants to be a good ball screen coverage guy. And this year he might get forced into playing the four a lot. So I don't know exactly how much of it we'll see. But I'm hoping that I can like buy into him as a true center if that comes along.
Okay. Now, I think that is fascinating to me. That is fascinating to me. I want to stick with that point because do you think he can protect the rim well enough to be a center? Because
right now, no.
Yeah, but I guess sort of in the longer term, because I've thought about him basically, you know, since he came onto the scene as pretty much a pure four.
Yeah.
That like, I don't think there's, you know, I don't think he offers enough as a combination of on the glass and as a shot blocker to be a five. But if he doesn't shoot better than 27%, he can't really be a four given the rest of his skill set either.
Yep.
So
yeah,
so
he's still stuck. Yeah,
yeah. If you're hopeful that he could be a center, then I'm much more hopeful because I hadn't even thought about that possibility. Just because he doesn't, in my mind, have the defensive chops. But if he can get there, it's much easier to see him fitting as a small ball center than it is as like a, you know, good enough size but not particularly special at anything power forward.
Yeah. And like, yeah. And then like some of like the passing feel stuff, I think, gets negated a little bit too, if you're able to like play him at the five more. I'm like hopeful. Like, I wouldn't say I'm optimistic about it, but I'd say that like, I'm hoping that given the strides he made last year, that one more year in this system where like the offensive role isn't so big and he's going to have a coaching staff that can kind of key in with him on like, here's how you're going to defend pick and roll. Like, maybe that gets there. And then maybe it's a thing where, maybe not in every single lineup because the rebounding, like you mentioned, but if a team is going smaller, if you're playing Oklahoma City and Jalen Williams is at the five for a stretch, like then you can, like Arkansas J-Dub, not Santa Clara J-Dub, like then you can get away with it. Or like when teams go to smaller lineups, you can play the five against them. Like, that's kind of what I would hope.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny because watching the Kings in the early season, as I do and watch them all season, whether it's good or bad, which mostly is bad, but you know, the idea of that is very interesting to me when I see someone like Trey Lyles being run out there. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, you know, this doesn't work for 5 minutes, but it works for 3 minutes, right?
Yeah.
If you can get it to work for 3 minutes every quarter, right, then you're a backup center. You know, mm-hmm. seems, you know, asinine to say that, right? But like, okay, you know, 12 minutes a game, three in each quarter, change of pace kind of guy. I think that works. And with Trey Lyles, you know, he's more of a four, first of all, because
and a much better shooter too. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say he has much better passing feel.
That too. Yeah.
And, you know, certainly in the Kings offense, you need passing feel at least to some degree to be able to stick around. But, you know, if that's the concept as, you know, switch it up kind of small ball center, you know, the last couple of years have not been great for him, but Darius Saric has been that at times in his career mm-hmm. as well. You know, someone who you just look at the frame and the height and you think this guy can't play center. But if enough of the skills fit with what you want from a small ball five, maybe that's an easier context than like, you know, he is a ridiculous athlete, but does he do anything else well enough as a four? Maybe not. If he's an athletic five, maybe that's an easier fit to sort of mm-hmm. figure out.
For sure. Yeah, I think it's interesting. I'm open to the idea of him as a four. I just like want to see him shoot it. I think it's like, or if like he plays alongside of spacing five or whatever, but like, I feel like that qualifier applies to so many people that it's yes. like tricky to like roll that out as a serious argument.
It's like, oh, if only he played with the fusion of Zion Williamson and Miles Turner, we'd be able
yeah, to then he would be great. Yeah.
His name is Chet Holmgren, by the way. Anyway, moving on to the fifth player on the list, soon to be teammate of Grant Nelson yeah. at Alabama, Cliff Amari, who is someone who checks a lot of the traditional center boxes. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious because I feel like I've always been lower on him, but
yeah.
slightly lower. Like, not yeah. like I don't think this guy's a prospect kind of lower, but like everybody else has him in the 50s and I have him in the 70s kind of lower.
I always have him there. Yeah. I like Amarui. So Cliff Amarui is like one of those guys where I think like certain players just like hit you in the face with really simple stuff and it makes them kind of boring. Like sure. there is like a, like I would be stunned if Clifford Amarui is like a legitimate starting center for an NBA team ever. Like, I just don't think it's in the cards straight up. Like, it's not, but I think that he's a guy that you can play in any NBA game and he will not get you killed. And I think that like means something.
No, it really does.
Yeah. So last year, 12.8 block rate. Like, he's always one of the best shot blockers in the country. His measurements are absurd. He was at Elite Camp 2 years ago. And like, that was the year him and Colin Castleton like destroyed Elite Camp and then they didn't get the combine invite. And I was fuming. So he had a 7.6 1/4 wingspan and a 9.2 1/4 standing reach. So like, measurements are awesome. He moves super well, like really good laterally. And like so quick to react with his hands and fast off the floor. And like, he does have these big, like athletic big man shot blocks where like he just flies and swats something. But a lot of his blocks are almost like sort of muted in terms of how they come off on tape, because it's just like, oh, he got to that ball really quickly before, like he didn't pinpoint it at its highest point and swat the ball out of the air. It's just like, he saw it coming off that guy's hand. And he got his hand there right away and blocked it. Like, he is a very good, like technically proficient shot blocker. And then offensively, like, he's going to be a lob guy. Like, that's all he's going to be at the NBA. Rutgers tried to post him up a lot. I think that was a really bad idea because I don't think he has very good touch. He's a really bad passer. But when they did pick and rolls with him, he scored like 70% of his shots on pick and roll. Like, if you just make him roll to the basket and dunk the ball, like, you're fine. Like, and again, like, it's going to be limiting. Like, you're not going to really be able to play five out with him. You're not going to be able to have him like orchestrate a lot of offense from the top of the key. Like, it's going to be a very simplified role, but I'm confident he can play that role. And it's a role that has real utility because he's going to bolster your defense significantly and he's going to have gravity rolling to the rim.
I'm glad you brought up the passing thing, because I think that's probably why I'm lower on him more mm-hmm. than anything else. And totally. Part of it is because I'm a sucker for big men who can pass. Like, that's just one
and
of my...
And it's becoming more of a necessity. Like, it's yeah. a real reason to be concerned.
So, you know, it's less of a weak point for me now. Now you've given me justification for my philosophy. So thank you for that. But no, I mean, you know, on a more serious note, right? Like, yes, I could absolutely see the world in which a team brings him in on a two-way and someone gets hurt and he ends up playing, you know, 15 minutes a game during a stretch in January. And the team says, all right, we've seen enough. We're converting him to a full contract. He's going to be our backup / third string center. Mm-hmm. Great. But, you know, for me, the issue is because he doesn't do much outside of those sort of traditional big man things, it has to be perfect context. And that's getting harder and harder to find for anybody. You know, like a lot of teams nowadays, you know, a lot of the churn sort of at the bottom of rosters is, you know, can we find someone to fill this hyper specific 10th man, 9th man role for us? Mm-hmm. And, you know, is there a situation in which Cliff Omorie could be that guy? Yes, there is, but I'm not sure that means you need to draft him. And that's sort of that's where it's the confusion comes into play for me.
I think a real like draft philosophy question too, of like, I always am leery of like certain guys I had lower on my board this year because like I think this guy could like play in a game tomorrow and be fine, but I also don't think this guy will ever be worth more than a minimum contract.
Sure.
And if I can just get Cliff Omorie on a minimum in 2 years, why do I need to be the team that drafts Cliff Omorie? Like, and I think their teams are going to make sense. Like, I think the Knicks are happy that they drafted Arlo Hook-Porty right now. Like, I think, like, again, similar thing. Like, the guy's boring, but he finishes shots and he blocks shots. And now, like, oh, no, we need a center. Like, hey, at least we've got this guy. Like, I think, just quickly,
because he was the last pick in the draft, I have to stand for Arielle Hook-Porty. So, please continue. Just
I like him, too. Like, I had him, like, in that range. Like, because it's the same thing. It's like, this is boring, but, like, I know that it can work. Like, I'm, you know, and, like, that's how I feel about Omorie. Like, I wish I could give a sexier sales pitch for him, but it's just, like, I know that guy. I am very confident in his ability to, like, play in an NBA game and be fine.
I guess the difference for me is I'm much more comfortable with Hook-Porty's ancillary skills than I am with Omorie's. And, you know, again, we're talking about the difference between... we're talking about, you know, the difference between winning the Isaiah Thomas Award and being a two-way undrafted guy, right? You know, it's all on the margins anyway.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
So before we close out, I just wanted to get to one of your quick hits at the back of the piece. I promise I can speak English. One of your quick hits at the back of the piece where you covered Hanson Yang. And this was the tease from the top of the podcast. Hanson Yang was someone that I saw in person at the California Classic Summer League in July. And it was fascinating. I saw him in two games, and the first of those games, he looked so incredibly fluid and massive and impossible to stop on the block. And the defensive effort was extremely not there, and it looked very intentional. No, I don't mean that as an insult. I mean that in a sense of like, it looked very clearly like the instruction he was given was don't get yourself hurt playing in Sacramento Summer League for
teachers. Yeah, yeah.
Don't do that. Like, as long as you don't do that, we're fine. The second game was a lot more concerning because he wasn't quite able to get position on the block. He wasn't quite able to hit his shots. And when he can't do both of those things, his passing game doesn't come into play. And, you know, again, the defense was like, it was very difficult for me to parse how much of this is you're being told to not get yourself hurt. And how much of this is, oh, you might actually be that slow-footed. And
yeah,
that's a concern I have. And again, because I'm a sucker for passing big man, I'm not ever going to be fully out on Hanson Yang. Mm-hmm. But it was a very odd experience of there weren't many players in that summer league who had higher highs. There was pretty much no one who had lower lows.
A very odd experience is like the perfect summation of Hanson Yang. It's it's so just like mesmerizing because when it's good, it's really good. And then the bad stuff, I'm just like, oh, there's no way. Like, there's no way. Like, when it goes wrong, I'm just so out on him. And like, that's the reason like I don't have him near my top 60. It's just like, I just think athletically he's really far away. And like when you mentioned like the positioning on the block, like that's something that was really concerning to me in the CBA tape is like, there's just too many plays where he's getting stripped inside by a small guard and stuff like that, where it's like, I need you to like power up and finish through that. Like there are very few NBA bigs that would be losing the ball in this situation. Like, I think he's definitely moving better now than he was a year ago, but like there's a limit on how hot his motor can run. And I just think if he were to come over now, there'd be too many games where it's like, I always like to ask the question, like, is this guy going to embarrass himself in an NBA game? And like, that's like something I like about Omorie is like, Omorie might not be good. Like, he might have NBA games where he's clearly not good, but it's not going to be like, oh my gosh, like, how did this guy get here? Where, like, I think with Hanson Yang, he could experience that if he were to come over too soon. But again, like, I love the skill. I love the fluidity that he moves with. And I think his touch is awesome. Like, some of the touch shots he hits, I'm just like, ooh, like, I know the free throw numbers aren't there. I know the 3-point numbers aren't there, but it just feels very translatable to me. And like, there's some stuff with his hands on defense that I think is really important. If you're going to be one of those bigs that has a harder time protecting the rim, is being able to use your hands defensively and deflect passes and get to steals and kind of disrupt things. I worry about the power. I worry about the overall athletic profile, but I think he's so skilled that it's like, let's keep a bookmark here. Like, let's not like shut the door on this, but I'm much lower on him as like a 2025 proposition than I think other people are.
Yeah. I mean, I think for it to be a 2025 proposition, it would have to be a team that is very invested in having him spend a year in the G League. I mean,
yeah.
It's fascinating that you bring up the strength thing, because that's part of the biggest confusion is, you know, he's listed at 7'1". When I saw him in Summer League, it's hard to look bigger than 7'1", but he looked bigger than 7'1". Like, he easily had 2 or 3 inches on Jake Stevens, who's listed at 7 feet.
Yeah. And Jake Stevens is like, I think he was like a barefoot 6'11¾" at Portsmouth.
Exactly.
Like, so he's that.
And, you know, so Hanson was clearly bigger than him, but, you know, Jake Stevens is also like well-built 275, and Hanson did not look small in that sort of frame context next to him either, which is why the sort of lack of power confuses me more than anything else, because he looks like someone who should be able to just rip through guys and score over them. And especially given the incredible finesse and touch that he has around the rim, if he can, you know, be stronger with the ball going up to the hoop, then, you know, he has everything else that he needs around the basket, right? But it's one of those things where it's like, okay, you know, the fact that he's, you know, has he turned 20 yet? I think he's still
19.
Yeah, I think he's still
close to it.
He's either still a teenager or just barely no longer a teenager, to the point where it's like, okay, you know, the strength should develop as it should.
Yeah, he's still not, he's a young 19. He doesn't turn 20 until June.
Yeah, okay, there we go. Right, so, you know, he's still so young that it's like, you expect him to put on, you know, valuable weight. You expect him to get stronger. But, I mean, if he doesn't, you know, again, I think that's, you know, really the whole bit is, when he looks good, he looks great. When he looks bad, he looks awful. And if he can't get stronger, then, you know, like, he's never going to be beating anybody up the floor in a sprint, right?
No.
So because of that, the strength becomes even more important. It's like, okay, this is the one physical tool that you should know going into every single night, every matchup. Is like, all right, unless I'm facing Victor Wembanyama or Zach Edey, I'm going to be taller and stronger than the guy I'm facing. And just take advantage of that and, you know, use times when, you know, defenses swarm to you to take advantage of your exceptional passing gifts, because he really is an exceptional passer. But, you know, it's like, again, the problems loom so large that even I, as someone who's higher on him, thinks the chances of him being a this year guy are pretty slim. And I thought the chances of him being a last year guy was like, when I saw him in Sacramento, I was like, I'm really glad he didn't declare for last year's draft, because someone would have hurt him in Summer League. And, you know, if he'd been playing for a team that wasn't like, okay, don't try all that hard defensively, like, if he was, you know, trying to fight for a roster spot for the Charlotte Hornets, he genuinely might have gotten hurt in one of those Summer games.
For sure. Yeah, I'm hopeful, but he's got plenty of time. Like, he's a guy where, like, I'm just gonna touch and go with him. Like, I'll check back on him here or there, but, like, unless he declares, I don't know how much I'm gonna be going back to his tape, like, during the year, unless something dramatic changes.
All right. Anything else you want to cover here before we wrap this one up?
No, I think we're good. Make sure you read the article. Follow me on social media at Boundboards. Got a big one coming next week on the top 10 games to scout in week one of the college basketball season. Started work on that today. Super, super excited about it.
Perfect. You did all the plugs for me. Saved me about 30 seconds. Appreciate that.
Anytime.
All right. He is Maxwell Baumbach. You can find him, as he already mentioned, on Twitter at Boundboards, and you can find his written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com. You can find me on Twitter at NBA Johnson, and you can find my written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com. We're currently working through our conference preview series, so be sure to be on the lookout for that. And then starting next week, we will go back to having more feature articles in addition to the one that Maxwell put out on Monday for all of you No Ceilings Plus subscribers. So if you've been enjoying the show, please take the time to leave a rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you might be using. That's always much appreciated on our end. If you aren't subscribed to the podcast or to the YouTube channel No Ceilings TV, please be sure to do that as well. And if you have any feedback regarding the deep dives portion of the podcast, feel free to reach out to me either via Twitter or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.